Great. Welcome, everybody, to our event today. My name is Joanna Ewart-James. I'm the Executive Director of Freedom United. We're about to start our event on certifications. Meanwhile, please write in the chat where you're joining us from. We'd love to see our supporters from all over the world joining, and we'll also be recording this session and sending an email with a link so you can also watch it back. So we're asking today, are labels like fair trade the answer to ending exploitation in supply chains? Freedom United is a US registered nonprofit. We're a global community, and we share our vision for a world without slavery, without any form of modern slavery. So we came to this topic because we're often asked about how to buy slavery free. We also held an event on boycotts earlier this year, and this question on certification schemes came up again. Also, Human Rights at Sea invited me to write the foreword for their newly released report examining schemes, certification schemes in the fisheries and agriculture industries. And just last week, I was over in Ivory Coast in the far west near the Liberian border, meeting cocoa bean farmers. And the chocolate industry is one of those that we are familiar probably with some of the schemes that we're going to be talking about today. Now, I want to just be clear, we have used fair trade in the title as it is one of the best known to consumers of these different certification schemes, but there are in fact many more, like for example, Rainforest Alliance, GOTS for garments, UTZ, and many, many more. Indeed, Human Rights at Sea's report covered 23 different schemes. So we'll be talking today more broadly about these certification schemes. For this webinar, we've chosen to look at three consumer products: cotton, cocoa, and seafood, all of which are linked to labor exploitation and modern slavery, and all of which have global supply chains. Some certification schemes are unique to specific sectors, and as we'll learn, they vary not just in approach, but also in the issues that they seek to address. So we hope that by looking at these three commodities, we'll have an opportunity to get a broader picture and understanding that we can apply to all commodities. So in welcoming you and our panel, I'm going to first introduce Monica, our senior campaigner, who leads our work on cocoa and also our campaign for stronger legislation on corporate accountability. Monica will introduce our speakers for the panel discussion, after which we'll have time for a Q&A session. So if you have any questions during the conversation, please do put them in the Q&A button at the bottom of your screen. If you enjoy the event, please consider making a donation to support Freedom United to bring you more like these. And also, if you post at all about it, please tag us at Freedom United HQ. So over to Monica, our senior campaigner at Freedom United, to introduce our panel discussion. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Joanna, for that introduction, and thanks to everyone who is tuning in from all around the world today for what I hope will be a very interesting discussion. It's my pleasure to introduce our wonderful speakers for today's event, starting with Umida Niyazova, who is the director of the Uzbek Human Rights Forum, which she founded in 2008 in Berlin, where she lived in exile following persecution in her home country, Uzbekistan, for her work as a journalist. She's been an integral part of ending the state-sponsored system of forced labor there through her work on the cotton campaign. We're also joined by David Hammond, who is the CEO at Human Rights at Sea, which he founded in 2014 after witnessing firsthand the scale of human rights abuses that take place at sea. A former Royal Marines officer and English barrister, he has worked in challenging environments, teaching and practicing international human rights and international humanitarian law around the world. And last but not least, we have Evelyn Ban, who is the Business and Human Rights Advisor for Sustainable Cocoa at the Inkota Network. Evelyn has over 15 years of experience on human rights issues in global supply chains, focusing on violations in the cocoa supply chain. She advocates for chocolate companies to assume their responsibility, and she campaigns for due diligence regulations from European governments. Now, before we get started with our panel discussion today, I'd like to start off by sending out a quick poll to the audience to hear your thoughts on the question that we posed in this event's title. So it is an anonymous poll, so no pressure, and it's just to give us a sense of sort of what our starting points are on this issue. So I think the poll should now be available for you. So I'm just going to give you a minute to read the question, and then we'll take a look. That's great to see so many answers coming in. Remember, there's no pressure. It's not an exam. It's just to get a sense of what people's opinions are. So I see right now we have roughly 13% have said yes, 29% have said no, and 50 is going up as I speak. 59% have said I'm not sure. So it means you're in the right place, because we're going to really address this question in a lot of detail, hopefully, through the course of this event. So let me just close the poll quickly, and then we can get going with our conversation. So as Joanna mentioned, people in the Freedom United community often ask us about certification labels and whether they mean products were made without the impact of modern slavery or major environmental harm. And it can be quite confusing for consumers to navigate and interpret all the different labels that are out there. So I thought we could maybe start off by just sort of setting the scene for the cases of cocoa, cotton and seafood. I'd like to come to you first, David, if that's okay, and just ask you to give us a very brief overview. I know this is a big question, but just a brief overview of what some of the main certification schemes in the seafood sector are, and maybe what they focus on, just in a nutshell.
Thank you, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with my fellow panelists today. In terms of the maritime environment, I won't talk about sectors, I'll talk about the maritime environment. We've really focused on the fisheries and aquaculture sectors, as was highlighted by Joanna at the start. We've recently issued a report on updated data sets, and I've put the link into the chat for everybody to go to. There is actually a dedicated page with the released data sets at the first round of a review. And what we've done at first instance is look at what is out there against set KPIs. And those are very subjective KPIs to the views of human rights at sea as a civil society organisation. The scope is very wide, and of course you have the big players in there from both aquaculture and on the fisheries side. What we have seen is a large variation in transparency, in accountability, and about engagement. And it is the first stage for us of a year-on-year review, every 6 months. But the size and scale of a multi-billion dollar in terms of a multi-trillion dollar supply chain is enormous. And to round off, what we are finding is that some of the certification schemes are open, they want to improve, others are closed, and others simply don't want to engage. So that's setting the scene, and I'll pass it back to you. Thank you.
Thanks, David. That was nice and brief, yeah. And I think this is a really important point that you raised already about there's diversity in this certification industry between different schemes. So Evelyn, maybe you could tell us, and for COCO, would you also say there's this diversity? If you could maybe set the scene in COCO and tell us what the main schemes are and so on.
Yeah, thank you, Monica. Let me just give two sentences on the background of the COCO sector. We have about 5.5 million COCO farmers, and they're small scale farmers. There's the issue of child labor and other human rights violations, but also environmental issues like deforestation. The industry knows about all those issues since more than 20 years. And the first reaction was that they would reach out to certification schemes. To that time, it was mainly fair trade being a certification scheme that said, we are going to certify it if certain standards are complied with. Now we have a situation that all big companies have a commitment that till 2025, so in 2 years, they have all their COCO certified. This can be with fair trade, or they say we use Rainforest Alliance, the green frog label, but they have also started, some of them, to build up their own company-owned labels. And this created a real label jungle, I would say, consumers have to navigate through. Let me first give some words on what Encota thinks about the company-owned labels. We feel they are very intransparent. It's not very clear what kind of standards are behind it. It's also not really independent verified from our perspective. And I think an important question is also what's the governance structure of company-owned labels. And differently than with fair trade, the farmers themselves are not really included in those governance structures. So then consumers are always very interested to hear about what is the difference between the Rainforest Alliance label and the fair trade label, basically the two biggest labels. Rainforest Alliance is the market leader, about one third of all COCO certified by Rainforest Alliance. And my answer is there is not a huge difference if you look into the standard. Many cooperatives are even certified by both, by Rainforest Alliance and by Fairtrade. And both standards said they take the audits of the others for themselves, so they acknowledge each other. But there's one fundamental difference between the two, and that's not about the standards itself. It's about the pricing the standards have included. And that's very important from the point of Encota, because for many human rights violations, poverty is a key, the main reason. And the difference between Rainforest Alliance and Fair Trade is Fair Trade has a minimum guaranteed price system. So if the world market price falls for COCO, the farmer still gets a minimum price. So now everybody here who's thinking, okay, great, then fair trade is the best and farmers get a fair price. I have bad news, because even the minimum price is too low that the typical farmer has a living income. And now my key message here would be all of those certification systems cannot be called sustainable systems, because as long as the farmer is not having a living income, we cannot talk about sustainability. And we have to see that no matter if it's Rainforest Alliance, Fair Trade, or the company labels, most COCO farmers, even the certified, live below the poverty line. But I'm happy to discuss this with you more.
Great, thanks, Evelyn. That's a really helpful overview. And I think, yeah, it's really interesting in COCO, the emergence of these company-owned labels, which is maybe not something that we see so much across other commodities. Okay, now I'm coming to you, Omida, to talk to us about the case of Cotton and give us a sense of what certification schemes are out there in Cotton.
Yes, thank you. So as a human rights organization, we monitor labor rights violations in Uzbekistan cotton sector. And the core of our monitoring is a deep understanding of the context of which these violations occur. So we analyze the problems and try to understand the causes and make recommendations to decision makers to improve the situation. Cotton cultivation requires a lot of water. You all know this, and you probably also heard that as a result of intense cotton production in Uzbekistan since the Soviet time, the Aral Sea, it once the world's largest freshwater lake, was has almost entirely dried up. So now 3.5 million tons of cotton are grown annually in Uzbekistan. And until just recently, the cotton sector relied on systemic child labor and forced labor. And we called to boycott all the cotton coming to Uzbekistan, that's why. And the following international campaign, the Uzbek government finally succeeded in implementing reforms and have now eliminated state-organized forced mobilization of kids and adults to pick cotton. So there are dozens of certification and standards for textile industry businesses. They focus on assessing management, quality system, standards for organic textile materials like fair trade. There's also Better Cotton Standard System. As they say, it's the largest sustainable program in the world. So the Better Cotton program developed seven kind of principles, such as crop protection, water, soil health, biodiversity, fiber quality, management system, and decent work. From our experience, what we know from experience working in Uzbekistan with the, for instance, with Better Cotton certification. So Better Cotton conducts monitoring for very limited time period only, which means that the right violations that happened outside that time frame make escape scrutiny. So we have seen this happen with the case of the one company, Singapore-based company, Interam Agro. We monitor. It's a cotton production company which is currently being considered for Better Cotton certification licensing. And for us, it's even shocking that the company which we, human rights organization, could name as one of the worst companies is going to get the Better Cotton certification as the first in Uzbekistan.
Hey, thanks for that. That's quite shocking, isn't it? Okay, so I think now we have a clearer picture of what certification schemes and cover in these sectors. So I'd like us now to discuss the role that certification schemes can play in improving also conditions for workers and communities affected by these supply chains. So Eveline, you already touched a bit on this in your first answer, but I'd love to hear your take on this for the cocoa sector. Sorry, you're on mute.
I think it's also to look at it from the farmer's perspective, right? Because if I argue the farmers still live in poverty, then you might think, okay, so why do farmers get certified? And I think if you are very, very poor, you appreciate any benefit you receive. So if I have talked to farmers in Cote d'Ivoire or in Ghana, what do you think about the certification schemes and why are you certified? And they say, well, we appreciate the support, like trainings, in-kind support, Also, being member of a cooperative is also very valid for them. It gives them also market access. And if you are very poor, you also appreciate the premium you receive. So it's still a benefit for the farmers to be part of a cooperative. Right now, it's also for farmer in Côte d'Ivoire being certified by fair trade, they receive a higher price for their cocoa than the farmers certified by Rainforest Alliance, because the minimum price system from fair trade currently kicks in, because the world market price or the farm gate price that's guaranteed to them is very low right now. So it is better than nothing, I would say. If it comes to the whole question on human rights, it's also that farmers are more sensitized for what are good practices, what can we do, and they are supported to find out ways if there's an issue in their community and how to tackle it, because they get the support from the certification schemes. What should the certifications do to push the sector forward? I think if they want to be claimed themselves to be very, really sustainable, then they have to take the companies accountable to pay a better price, because how can a farmer comply with all those obligations to do good agricultural practices, no child labor, et cetera, if they don't receive a fair price? And I think that's the point where I would say fair trade needs to increase the minimum price, and Rainforest Alliance has to start really thinking about how can we include in our system a pricing mechanism that makes sure farmers can have a living income.
Great, thank you for that. Okay, Omida, if we can come to you on cotton, if you can tell us in what ways you think that certification schemes and the textile industry can push the industry forward on issues related to human rights and labour rights.
When the child labor and forced labor in the cotton sector of Uzbekistan it's not the main problem, but we see that exploitative relations between farmers and textile companies are increasing, and now farmers are obliged to grow cotton for companies they've been attached. And it's perhaps possible to do an audit of the chemical composition of cotton, but if we on Uzbekistan's so experience, we see that if the cotton, even free of chemicals, the labor rights problems remains, and there is no guarantee that the organic cotton has been grown without human rights violations. And I mentioned the case of Indorama. So in 2016, Uzbek Forum, we filed a complaint with the International Financial Corporation against Indorama, which was in receipt of a loan to develop textile production in Uzbekistan. At that time, child labor in the cotton harvest was a massive systemic scale, and Indorama failed in its due diligence to ensure that there was no child labor in its supply chain. But later in 2018, Indorama received thousands of hectares of land from the state, and the land was illegally seized from farmers. And the company received further funding from IFC and European Bank for Reconstruction and Development to modernize its cotton production. So over the past years, we have been documenting poor working conditions, attempts to destroy the independent trade union at Indorama company. And still, Indorama is being considered for better cotton certification despite clear violations of the better cotton's decent work principles. So this naturally raises a big question about better cutting approach and other kind of certification schemes and verifications kind of problems.
Okay, thank you. So that's very clear that better cotton and other schemes in cotton need to be doing more to raise the standards. So yes, and David, what about in the maritime context? How can certification schemes push the industries forward on these issues?
Thank you. I'm going to start with framing the answer to say that from our experience and obviously experiences of many other NGOs and civil society is that time is simply not on our side to continue having this debate, certainly for victims and their families. So effectively, each day that passes without reporting, both either internal or public reporting, investigations or remedies, means that as another day passed for victims and those people who generally do not have a voice or have access to unions or unionisation, that they're going to suffer. In terms of the improvements, well, the position is very polarised in the maritime space. It's obviously industry driven, and which is then driven by consumers asking for that level of assurance that when they pick a product off the shelf to consume, that it doesn't have any form of human or labour rights abuses attached. But that polarisation is simply quite binary. There's either a need for certifications, or certainly the ITF has very recently on the 1st of March spoken to the retailers in the UK and said that certification should not be used in any way whatsoever because it stifles and prevents worker voice and worker engagement. But the question is, what are the options? At the moment, there are many certifications out there. They've traditionally been focused on environmental sustainability. And from our position in our report, it's very clear that human and labour rights abuses monitoring reporting is a simple bolt-on seen as an afterthought, which, of course, I would hope we all agree is wrong. We talk about environmental sustainability, but we're not talking about human sustainability. And actually, these certifications, the auditors, the CABs, and the entire industry would not be in existence at all without the workers who are doing the front end work. There are certification schemes that are better than others, and our report has started to highlight that, and we're going to delve even deeper in the coming months. But there are very few certification bodies that are public in those farms or those fisheries that they've certified, that they've either suspended or removed from the certification standard. And therefore, the transparency is not there because it's not being demanded by the consumer. And we believe it's also not being demanded loud enough by the retailers themselves. The other thing is that, as we all know, audits are probably worthless on paper because they have a set number of requirements, and those auditors are known when they're going to arrive, and they are in many respects conflicted for the people they audit for, because if they do find egregious human and labour rights abuses and start reporting it, it's likely that they're not going to be instructed. So that conflict of interest is a major issue. And then to round off, we certainly see, say, some organisations and some bodies who are wanting to improve their engagement with worker rights, with worker-led solutions, but very rarely do we see workers themselves actually being involved in the senior management and hierarchy and design of these certifications. So certifications for us in the seafood sector, across fisheries and aquaculture in particular, are quite nascent in their development and their outlook. I suppose the headline for us is the jury is still out.
Great, that's clear, very clear. And thank you also for giving us that reminder of the human cost of what we're talking about here and the urgency for us to for this issue to be dealt with. So now we've seen that, you know, there's a variety across the different commodities, but clearly certification schemes can play a role and be beneficial in at least reducing exploitation in supply chains. But, and I think I already know the answer from all three of you on this question, but is it currently enough for companies in these sectors to be fully certified? Or as I assume your answer is going to be no, let's go a bit further and then say, what else should companies be doing to really be able to call themselves sustainable or ethical, or you know, this human sustainability that David was referring to? Mida, let's start with cotton, if that's okay. What more do you think companies in the textile industry and companies using cotton need to be doing?
Yeah, like in authoritarian countries like Uzbekistan, there is no independent trade unions, and so there is only like a handful of independent human rights organizations, and even fewer with the experience to monitor labor rights violations. It's extremely challenging for any kind of certification schemes, I think, especially in the cotton sector, which has such a long history of the human rights, of massive human rights violations. I think recently in Germany, supply chain law came into force, the law obliged German companies to respect human rights in third countries where they operate. And I think that state enacting kind of progressive laws to protect human rights can, of course, determine how businesses behave in countries that lack kind of proper enforcement, human rights standards enforcement. And of course, responsible businesses often have more influence than anyone else in non-democratic countries, and are in position to urge governments where they operate to respect human rights. And there are a lot of German investments, for instance, in Uzbekistan textile and in Uzbekistan economy. And we really hope that this law maybe could help to improve situation.
Great. So it's really about businesses also using their sort of power with the government to call for due diligence laws. That's an interesting point. Thanks. Okay, maybe we can go to David next on this one.
I think businesses don't necessarily care one way or the other whether or not the certifications work, and the accountability, the deterrent effect, and the enforceability is actually what we should be looking at. And of course, it's a state responsibility to protect the human rights of the citizens, those workers that are within the jurisdiction of that state, or the reach of that state extraterritorially. I would actually frame it that certifications are here. They're not going to go away, despite the calls for them to be disbanded. The realities are that until states start stepping in and we start seeing state level requirements in national and international legislation for human rights due diligence that is enforceable, then we're going to be in this environment where certifications, which are actually businesses, although a lot say they're not for profit, but they are businesses making profit, and I'll come on to that point in a moment, are just going to continue to exist. Businesses, therefore, are going to fulfill their requirements for their suppliers. And actually, I think the power here, again, I mentioned earlier, is with the retailers pushing certainly at national and regional level. So, for example, European Union, we hope forthcoming legislation for mandatory human rights due diligence. That's where, if there's going to be a cleanup in the system, it's going to actually come not just from the state, but from the retailers. And indeed the suppliers themselves raising themselves up to say, we want to see enforceable mandatory human rights due diligence. The point I wanted to just go back to is, in the UK, a lot of certifications are actually registered under the charity, the UK Charity Commission, under UK charity law, as a charity. The amount of money that's being made and therefore taken away from workers in the maritime space is actually substantial. And what we're not seeing is the level of investment back into those communities with the profits that are being made. And actually, I would use this forum to call for a review, certainly from retailers, of certification standards, the profits that are made, and what is actually happening with those profits, and not for them just to be reinvested in the certification standard to make it better or glossier, or just to have a couple of projects that tick the box. If anything, those certification standards should have a limited life, should have limited reserves, and should be required by the retailers to put a large percentage of their profit back into the very communities that they say that they are protecting. And I just would like, if I could add just one more point. We are seeing a lot of the certification standards saying, but wait a minute, we just set the standard. We don't go out with the conformity assessment bodies. They're required to bring our standards or bring the farm or the fisheries or the fleet up to our standard. But there is a distinct lack of ownership of any abuses, of recording those abuses, and then actually doing anything about those abuses. And just adding on a piece within an audit that you need to check that there's no child labour or forced labour under the ILO forced labour principles is simply not enough.
Thanks for that, David. And that's a really interesting point that you bring up as well around the profits and the governance of these certification companies. Or charities. So Eveline, maybe we can also now come to you on COCO. I know there have been, just to reflect on the point that both Omida and David have made around companies' role in calling for due diligence law. I know there have been some calls from the chocolate company industry for due diligence law. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, but also more broadly, what you think companies should be, do you think companies should be going beyond certification and how?
Yes, thank you, David. I fully agree with you. I think we have to have probably a bigger impact if governments start having regulations that make companies responsible to fulfill human rights due diligence. And I think that's the key issue about certification schemes. The perspective of a certification scheme is, what has a farmer to do different? As a farmer has to comply with human rights, the farmer has to do better agricultural practices, the farmer should not have child labor, the farmer should not deforestation, the farmer should not use this and that pesticides. Everything all right, but who's looking what companies have to do different? And that's not in the certification scheme. They only look into what does the farmer have to do different. And I think we have to look into purchasing practices of companies. And one issue I see in the cocoa sector, we have like a lot of talks in the cocoa sector and sustainability, a lot of conferences and workshops and how can we get to a sustainable cocoa sector, but with whom do we talk there? We talk with the CSR people, we don't talk with the people from the purchasing departments. If we're happy, we talk with the CEO, but then he's delegating the whole issue to their CSR department. And I think if we want to really change something, we have to talk about purchasing practices of companies and see on how that is leading to unfair trading practices. And in the end, I also believe certification systems like Fair Trade and Rainforest Alliance have to shift to look much more into what do we ask a company to change in their purchasing practices in order that this company can use our seal, our label on one of their products. I think that would be a very important step. So now I'm German and I'm very happy we have one of the first countries having passed the human rights supply chain law. It's just started in January this year. And we already see that companies really reacting on that. one example for the cocoa sector is, if I asked like 5 years ago, where does the cocoa come from? Companies really said, we don't know, somewhere West Africa. Now, if you want to fulfill your human rights due diligence, you have to know where your cocoa comes from. And that's something we see already happening, that companies really start building up traceable supply chains. And I see a big opportunity here to take them more accountable for what is happening in their supply chain.
Great, thank you so much on that point. So my next question was going to be around the role of governments, but I think we have already all touched on the role of governments when answering that last question. But I do think it's such an important point here, as in, you know, we're, as consumers, you know, pulling our head out in the supermarket aisle saying which seal do I want to buy? When actually we need to also look to governments to be taking the responsibility for sorting this issue out for us, or helping to sort out this issue for us. So yeah, I do want to give us a little bit more space for that question. No worries if you think you've said everything you need to say on government's role in ending exploitation and supply chains, but I do want to just do one last round on that in case you want to go a little bit deeper into the topic of due diligence law or other ways in which governments can be involved. And Omida, I think the case, obviously you haven't worked on the case of state-sponsored forced labour, and I'm sure you have lots to say on this. So why don't we start with you then?
Yes, I think that it's clear that it's a state policy. It's is fundamental in promoting decent labor rights standards. And so in Uzbekistan achieved, as Uzbek activists say, historic and even revolutionary changes in the cotton sector, because state policy changed, because the massive forced labor issue was different than, let's say, in the countries like, I don't know, India and Bangladesh, where there was other reasons for the forced labor. And in Uzbekistan, it was government organized. And of course, for the government, it was easy just to stop, to mobilize kids and adults to go to work for the government. Of course, there was a lot of international pressure behind this, and especially calls to boycott of Uzbek cotton, and more than hundreds retailers and different kind of international companies, they joined this boycott. But nevertheless, at the end, it was the state who decided to stop using, let's say, kids, 1 million. We're talking about 1 million kids who were forced to go to pick cotton every year. And yeah, of course. And I just wanted to, before I forget, mention that after the German supply law chain came in force, we also starting to receiving some calls from some of the German investors who were asking us about the conditions, about the situation with the labor rights situations. And it was, honestly, it was the first time when businesses, when companies came to human rights organizations and asked about this. So I think that it's very important that the states like the Germany and European Union will definitely adopt this kind of progressive laws to support labor rights and to avoid labor rights violations in the countries, in the authoritarian countries. Thanks.
Great, thank you so much. Evelyn, maybe you want to add something, I don't know, maybe also about the EU law or something else on how governments can play a role in ending exploitation and supply chains.
Okay, we have talked now about the due diligence law in Germany, and there's a process right now on EU level to have a regulation on EU level on a due diligence law. I think that's a very important step. I still think we should also keep thinking about other possibilities on how governments could create a space where it can address purchasing practices, for example, of companies. And I think two possible ideas I have, and I'm very happy to discuss this with anybody who's interested in it. I think we have to talk about competition law, because like I said, pricing is a very important issue. But every time we come and ask companies, let's talk about pricing. I just saw in the Q&A, somebody said, can we have a pledge of every company to pay a certain price? They will tell you immediately, oh, that's not possible because of competition law. So I think here governments have to jump in and create a competition law that allows that this kind of initiatives can be done. Then the second thing is, I find very interesting in Spain and France, I don't know if somebody is here from Spain and France, there are laws that prohibit to pay a price for a product under the production costs. And we know in cocoa farmers are not even able to pay to cover their production costs. I think that's very interesting to look into that and how that works. And if anybody here has from their country experiences other ideas on how to use legislations to address global supply chains or purchasing practices of companies, or if you have some crazy idea, I think everything is welcome to look into it and see what comes out of it. I mean, 20 years ago, when I started to work in the NGO industry or sector, everybody said, no, we will never have a human rights due diligence law. And I think, you know, we're here now. I mean, with all our work making those cases published, the governments were forced to react. And I think we can change something. I put my email in the chat. So if anybody has an idea, just reach out to me.
Great, I love that. Thank you so much, Evelyn. And David, finally over to you on the topic of governments and their role in ending exploitation and supply chains, if you had anything to add.
Well, the exploitation is going to be prevented and reduced when we see effective enforcement. And with enforcement, I'm talking about certainly state level prosecutions of abusers. And criminal prosecutions are invariably public record. The problem with having civil suits or say arbitration is that it's generally behind the closed door. It's a confidential process, and the outcomes are often not made public. So the deterrent effect will only come through public awareness, because Company X is, if it sees that Company Y has been prosecuted for not upholding both national or international law in relation to human and labour rights standards and the related instruments, then they're not going to want to either be in court or be in the limelight, because actually it affects their brand and that's their strength. The other thing is that what we are seeing, particularly in the fisheries sector, is states stepping in and actually enforcing human and labour rights standards within licensing conditions for foreign fleets coming into coastal states, seeking the licenses to operate within their waters, within the economic exclusion zone around that coastal state. And that's increasingly being effective, because if the licensing conditions are breached, then the license can be withdrawn. And therefore, as soon as that's withdrawn, you have no product being fished from the sea. There is no output, and it therefore hits the company and that part of the supply chain financially. The other part is that lobbying of governments by the sectors that we're covering is extensive. You know, a huge amounts of money are used in that lobbying function. And what we're seeing is that sectors are setting up so-called NGOs, which are frankly just a whitewash, because they are interest groups that are given either a charitable status or an NGO status and are actually part of the problem, because they are only representing the interests of industry. And therefore, I think governments need to take a much stricter approach, both the flag state, the coastal state, and indeed port state authorities, to the recognition of those NGOs and those civil society organisations that are actually corporate fronts. And then finally, what I'd say is when we're looking at governments holding holding individual companies accountable, I think they also have to hold certification bodies accountable. And indeed, the certification bodies also have to hold the CABs and the auditors accountable. And what we would like to see is the certification bodies delisting and publicly delisting auditors who have failed to address or identify very obvious egregious human and labour rights abuses during their auditing. And again, that goes to deterrent effect and auditors and indeed the CABs to take a much more serious approach to looking out for the indicators of forced labour, for example, or egregious human rights abuses.
Brilliant. Thanks, David. I think that's given us a really good sense of how different actors need to step up. So I think before we move on to our audience Q&A, I'd like to just repeat the poll that we did at the beginning and just check if we've got a different answer, if people feel like they have more of a formed opinion after listening to these experts talk on the subject or not. Again, it's an anonymous poll, feel free to answer truthfully. This is just for us as well to see. Great, lots of answers coming in. Okay, I think we will end it. Well, there's still a couple coming in, but we're going to end it because we need to move on to the audience questions. But if you see the under, I'm not sure, we've gone from 59% to 37%. So I would say that is a success. That means that we've presented lots of valuable information to help people sort of form their opinion on this topic. So thanks very much to our speakers for taking us through how this works in different sectors. So I would now pass over to Joanna then, if you could please lead us through the audience questions.
Thank you so much, Monica, and thank you very much to our speakers for that real deep examination of three sectors and certification schemes. Now, we have received quite a few questions from those who've sent them in advance as we invited, and of course during the event. Some are quite specific, and I know we've got some brilliant people as well amongst our participants. So if you actually know the answer to a question that you see, do feel free to answer it yourself as well in the chat box. And for those of us who are with us live, I'm hoping to be able to unmute you so that you can ask the question yourself. But to start, I shall start with a question that I know might be burning in some people's minds, which is really about, as individuals yourselves, thinking about consuming, as obviously we all do, like do you look for certification labels, or if not, how do you advise people to shop more ethically? So I'm sorry, I didn't address the person I will start that question with. So I would like to ask that to Umida. So do you look for certified cotton when you're shopping? And what do you recommend people in our audience would do?
Yeah, it's not an easy question, actually. I'm inclined to buy products where it says fair trade or organic cotton. Although I understand that it doesn't guarantee anything. And only my advice will be, for example, never buy cotton clothes in cheap stores, because, you know, there are so much like labor lies behind a single t-shirt. And if the price for the clothes is like just a few euros, it definitely means that someone in chain of its production didn't get paid properly. So, and Yeah, I think that I don't have like special recommendations how to guarantee that there is no human rights violations under the product. But in general, of course, I'm glad that especially here in Europe there are we have so many kind of responsible consumers.
Thanks, Imida. I think what we've heard just through the presentations is that quite clearly a guarantee is unfortunately elusive and not possible to find. So giving yourself a better chance as a consumer is one thing, but guaranteeing is quite different. And I think that's really pertinent, Evelyn, when we think about cocoa, right? Because as you mentioned, you know, a lot of farmers, and I saw myself, are just not earning enough for a living income. And there's a question we have from the audience, from Lauren. Let me see if I can give you an opportunity to answer this question, Lauren. You could ask it directly to Evelyn, and you'll just need to unmute yourself. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you so much. Yeah, I've just recently, you know, I've been following this a lot. I know not to trust the certifications, but I'm kind of interested in if direct trade, which has seemed like a good solution to what's taking place, but I've heard it's not really working in Western Africa. And so I run a nonprofit and we do have our own list of chocolates we do and do not recommend based on country of origin. And we're running into issues on what is really reliable when it comes to Western Africa. And thank you so much for this webinar and Evelyn for all of your wisdom.
Yep, I also believe that direct trade is a very important step, and that's also having to do with purchasing practices, right? And it should not only be direct trade, but companies should have long-term relationships with cooperatives. So they really get to know them, they know their problems, they can react on the problems. I think, and I'm saying that with, I know it's also not perfect, but Tony Chocolonely's, the company, is a step really in the right direction. They look that they pay a higher price. From NGO perspective, that's not high enough, but it's way more than, for example, under the fair trade system. They have long-term relationships to the cooperatives. And I think that's an example for West Africa that is going into the right direction. I would also make one point, if you would ask me about what I look to if I buy chocolate. I started to look more on organic certified chocolate for one reason, because studies show that it really increased that farmers use pesticides in the cocoa sector. And that has to do that a lot of companies pushed farmers to grow cocoa in monocultures. So that's why they need to use more pesticides. And that's also, if we talk about child labor having an effect on the children, because studies also show that more and more children are in contact with pesticides in the cocoa sector. So that's one thing I'm personally, because I think we need also to have a shift on how cocoa is grown. I think we need much more agroforestry or organic cocoa.
Thanks, Evelyn. I think that's really helpful as well to think about the, if you like, the kind of side benefits of organic, which obviously is mostly focused on pesticides, but that's a really useful answer. And thanks for your question, Lauren. Petra has a very closely related question that I'd just like to jump in and ask you to answer to, if Petra would like to ask it live. I also would like to add a little something after you've spoken, Petra.
My question was simply, what is the burden of getting certified for a cocoa producer, for a cocoa farmer who is already very impoverished.
Thanks a lot, Petra. This is a really important and pertinent question. Last week, I met some cooperatives in Ivory Coast who had explained that they'd gone through a lot of hoops to get certified, and then said that when it come to the time to sell their product, there wasn't a market to sell it as certified product. So that's just heartbreaking to hear. Evelyn, does that line up with what you understand of the system?
Yes. One thing is a cocoa farmer has to be organized in a cooperative to become part of a certification scheme from Rainforest Alliance and Fair Trade. So if a cocoa farmer is living in a very area which is far away from infrastructure, etc., they don't even have the contacts to become part of that cooperative. Then it's correct that there's more certified cocoa by Rainforest Alliance and Fair Trade than buyers of that cocoa. So a lot of certified cocoa is not sold as a certified cocoa, and that means the farmer is not receiving the premium. So now you might ask, didn't you just say there's a 2025 promise by all the companies to have certified cocoa? Yes, there is, but they're not going to use all Rainforest Alliance and Fair Trade. They're a lot of companies going to use their own company programs. So I also believe that this is really frustrating for the farmers if they are certified and then they find out, okay, we sell our cocoa, but we just get a regular price for it and nobody wants to buy it as certified.
Thanks. Absolutely. It is incredibly frustrating because, of course, you know, there are standards, which is the whole point of the scheme, and that responsibility does seem to sit on those who are less able to actually maintain or implement those standards. We are going to go on for another few minutes because the questions are great. I think the conversation's brilliant. I hope you're able to stay. We have a question from Josia Ovari. I think, Josia, I can allow you to ask your question. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you so much. My question is that most of the certification schemes are often based on audits. However, like, these audits are just looking at one point in time, as we learned today. And I wonder if grievance systems are part of these schemes as well. In cotton or textile, I know from Fairware that, of course, this is a grievance system, but I would like to know also for the maritime sector and for cocoa if grievance systems where the workers can directly reach the retailers or the brands are part of these certifications.
Great. David, can you answer the question on certification schemes and grievance mechanisms?
Yeah, I think it's a really great question. From our perspective, grievance mechanisms not should, but must be mandatory. They must be embedded throughout all of the certification standards, but they must also be enacted by the auditors themselves. And that's where I spoke earlier about auditors and auditing firms being held accountable. What we're starting to both see and indeed hear is litigation, not towards the certification standards themselves, but actually the auditors for failure for doing their jobs. It's not mandatory. It should be mandatory. And it's something that certainly when you're looking at worker-led voice, grievance mechanisms and worker involvement in the design and construct of certifications is something that is pushed by large sections of civil society we're involved in. And indeed, I can't speak for the unions, but I would consider that is part of their view, though, as I said, ITF did make it very clear in the UK that there was no place for certifications, period. But yes, a good question and one I'd fully support.
Thanks, David. I actually think this is also a really important question For Umida to answer. I know, Jozia, you didn't mention cotton, but I think the situation in Uzbekistan, where you have got this real role of government in what was then a very much a state-sponsored scheme, does bring in another aspect to the fact that you wouldn't normally be able to go to the authorities that you might be able to when you experience a rights violation. So in those cases, what difference would an independent grievance mechanism make? Umida, could you answer that, please?
No. In the country when there is no any kind of trade unions and labor rights organizations, we see that grievance mechanism, actually it's a very important tool to bring the labor rights violations in light. And we are actually urging the new established so-called cotton clusters or textile companies to at least for now, when there is no trade labor rights, labor unions, trade unions, at least to establish grievance mechanisms and to establish something when the workers could go and raise their complaints. And like with Uzbekistan cotton sector, it's just kind of it's beginning of the process. And I just hope that when the international, like after the boycott was lifted, the more responsible international investors who are coming to the textile sector will be establishing this kind of progressive mechanisms for labor rights standards.
Thanks, Umida. Yes, I think that's really important to understand the context, because a very different response is needed in those contexts compared to what we would hope would be a more free environment, at least externally, if not for those who are being exploited. Now, we do know, of course, that in one of the big challenges in the seafood and fishery sector is the isolation that workers face. But I want to also get back to the questions. There's so many questions already that we've received, and there are quite a few that are specific to cocoa. So Evelyn, there is a very practical question here about Rainforest Alliance, whether they pay a premium, and also whether you have an opinion on divine fair trade. So Reed, perhaps I can just quickly call on you.
Yeah, and in the Rainforest Alliance system, there's also a premium foreseen, or they have two premiums. One is called the sustainability differential, and one is called the sustainability investment. The sustainability differential was set up for Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire for a minimum of $70 last year. What we have heard now from farmers in Cote d'Ivoire is it's not working. It's not really receiving them. They had problems to implement that system. Rainforest Alliance are working on it. The sustainability investment, which should go to the cooperative, the cooperative has negotiated what the buyer is going to pay to them as an investment. And I think that is not reflecting the market power between a farmer and between the cooperative and the buyers. Like you have just heard, some farmer cooperatives have issues to sell their certified cocoa as certified. I mean, that gives already an indication how little the negotiation power for the farmers is.
Reed, does that answer your question? Apologies, I think I asked it before I managed to unmute.
I'm good. I'm enjoying the answer. Thank you.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Reed.
On
divine chocolate, I need to say I haven't looked into it in the past years, and I would not feel comfortable to give a clear answer on how the situation is for divine chocolate and the cooperatives. So I think in general, obviously, it's a good idea to have the farmers owning also the company they sell the cocoa to, but how it currently works, I can't tell you. I might look into that and get back to you if you send me an email.
Great, sure. I think that's fine. Evelyn has generously shared her email in the chat, so please do ask that question. Anthony, your question, it's relevant to, I think, all our panelists. Do you have someone in particular you wanted to ask it to? And please do fire away.
No, anyone that would wish to answer, I'm open to everyone's opinion on the question.
Please go ahead and ask.
Yeah, I was wondering what the panelists thought about transparency laws and their effectiveness in terms of brands having to disclose full disclosure, supply chain mapping, both from tier one and all the way down to the raw materials level, and the role that can play in improving human rights and environmental due diligence.
Thank you. Who wants to kick off that challenging question of mapping, supply chain mapping, deep down the raw materials? And I think, you know, the three commodities we've chosen have very different types of supply chains. For sure, cotton is, I'm going to put my foot out and say that cotton is the most complex. But let's first start with David and answer that in the context of fisheries and marine life.
Sure. I think any established law within a state, be it, in this case, transparency laws, if they're effectively implemented within the contracts for the services, the terms and conditions, then you then have the ability to enforce. A law is only effective if it is enforced. So by having transparency laws available, and of course, not all coastal states or states will have transparency laws, but I would say that when you're looking at the state looking after the human responsibility for looking after the human rights within its jurisdictional boundaries, then it should be enforcing. And indeed, that should be within a Department of Trade, for example, a maritime department, certainly for us. But also what we're starting to see is that retailers, suppliers are themselves within their terms and conditions within the lower tiers, requiring within the terms and conditions of their contracts of services, goods and services, to apply such laws. So what I'd like to see is it being, as much as we have mandatory human rights due diligence, but we have mandatory requirements for transparency where laws are applied in the state. So that would be an excellent deterrent effect and enforcement tool.
Thanks so much, David. We are running tight on time, but there's such an important question here in the Q&A. I really want to get to it. I'm sure other people had opinions as well on the question before. But Freja, would you please like to go ahead and ask your question about purchasing practices?
Hello, everyone. I work in a university for applied sciences in Belgium. And I was wondering, what can we do? How can we change our purchase policies? What do you recommend that we include in our policies? Thank you. And I'd like to hear from all speakers.
We'll see if we have time. So I'd like to start with Umida. Would you like to contribute to this question on purchasing practices?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, as I said before, like, for instance, never buy cotton clothes in cheap stores. And this is because there are a lot of labor lies behind the textile production products. Despite the fact that all these certification and schemes has problems, but still I think that it's better to buy the organic cotton, and if there is a fair trade and other kind of licenses, products, when you have a like choice, better buy the products which has some license.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Amida. So as we bring this to a close, I do want to check if any of our panelists have a last comment, because I didn't give you all a chance to speak to the last couple of questions. Please put your hand up. There's a lot that we could talk about for a long time on this topic, for sure. So I don't necessarily expect that we'll manage to answer all the questions. David, please go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to make two quick points. There was an earlier question asked about what would I do in terms of certification labels. Within the seafood sector, I actually avoid certain certification labels when I'm buying seafood in the supermarket. And actually, if you have the ability to do so, and it's about cost, I insist within sort of circles that I work in, we buy local, we go straight to the fishers, we buy at source. Now, of course, that's not the case for retailers, but we also spend time talking to the producers to understand what all the issues and the challenge they have. And as I say, we put the money straight into their pockets, avoiding, they get the right price for their product. The other one is that, just to finish off from my perspective, for us on certifications, as I said earlier, the jury is out. We are taking an evidence-based approach in terms of all certifications we're looking at. So we're not going to burn down the certifications model. We want to give all certifications we are highlighting the very fair opportunity to improve, be transparent and accountable. And somebody highlighted earlier the scorecard. I certainly think there's room in the maritime environment for both ratings and scorecards across fisheries and agriculture. And that's what we will be pursuing. Thank you.
Thank you, David. I think that's a really positive and clear call to action for closing this event. That, you know, this is not about just saying that certification schemes are not achieving what we want to see, but actually saying that they could be doing a lot more, and there's a lot more that could be done. And how can we keep moving forward so that we don't see the kind of exploitation that's been described, but that we see, you know, a supply chains where people are treated fairly, they're not exploited. So I want to say a big thank you to all our panelists, to Evelyn, to Umida, to David, also especially to Monica for work organizing and moderating our panel. Thank you to everyone for joining us. If you'd like to see more events like this, please do make a donation to Freedom United. And a monthly donation definitely helps us give certainty for our future. I'll put the link in the chat. If you do put any posts out on social, I'd be really grateful if you tag us. But for now, thank you very much for your participation, for engaging comments. And I hope this leaves you with a lot of food for thought on how we can move forward to the world we want to see. Thank you.